We are going to get started. So welcome everybody. This is Unit 4, Session 2 of the ACES Aware Ventura County Virtual Lecture Series. We're glad that you are here. We will be recording this lecture. You saw the note just now pop up. So this lecture will be available on the ACES Aware Ventura County website after tonight at some point. I think everybody knows the etiquette for Zoom, but just as a reminder, please keep your microphones muted throughout the presentation, and there'll be an opportunity after the presentation to unmute and ask some questions. A reminder that everybody who's here tonight will be entered into a drawing for a custom ACES Aware Ventura County prize, and we will announce the winner in a follow-up email. So be on the lookout for an email from ACES Aware Ventura County. And then in your registration and evaluation, please make sure you noted whether you are requesting continuing education. And for those who are seeking continuing education, as a reminder, you must be present for the entire session and complete the evaluation to receive those credits. So with that, we're going to officially get started. My name is Sharon Elmansdorp. I'll be kind of moderating for this evening. I was formerly with First 5 Ventura County running Help Me Grow, and I was a big part of a lot of the ACES Aware Ventura County work. So I'm just glad to still be here and working with Dr. Landon and Imani and the team on this lecture series. So with that, we're going to transition to a quick introduction from Dr. Chris Landon.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining us for this session and as part of the AAVC Provider Training Lecture Series. We hope this session is both informative and engaging for you. Don't forget to register and complete the evaluation so we know who our audience is and how to improve in the future. All who register, including those who are watching this as a recording, will be entered into a raffle for a special ACES Aware Ventura County Prize. This lecture is being recorded, so you can have access to it on our website at any time. Thank you for joining us on our mission to bring better help, better health, and better hope to Ventura County and beyond.
And our speaker for tonight is Dr. Dominique Eugene. She'll be presenting on how to have an open dialogue about race, bias, and discrimination when considering ACEs. So Dr. Dominique Eugene is an early career clinical psychologist, a licensed marriage and family therapist, a registered play therapist and supervisor, a certified trauma specialist, and an infant, family, and early childhood mental health specialist. As a psychologist, she is well-versed in providing therapeutic interventions to underrepresented culturally and ethnically disadvantaged communities. She has co-edited 2-volume textbooks on mass trauma and emotional healing, written articles on cultural concerns, trauma, and play therapy. Her recent co-publications are titled Mental Health Among Children Older Than 10 Years Exposed to the Haiti 2010 Earthquake, A Critical Review, and Rwanda's Response During COVID-19 in the Psychological Trauma Theory, Research, Practice, and Policy Journal. She has provided presentations at national and international conferences in the areas of play therapy, disaster mental health, shame, depression, cultural interventions, and ethnic disparities. Some of her recent presentations have included Conversations from the Field, Helping the Healers, Addressing Racism and Social Justice in Infant and Early Childhood Mental Health, Conversation on Race and Social Justice, Being Black in America, Coronavirus on the Ground, Realities and Anticipations, and Adult Learners Surviving Doctoral Programs, Pressure with 3 P's, Navigating the Cultural and Social Impact of Academic Performance on Korean Adults. Adolescents. She has been offered a position as a Global Health Fellow for the 2020 to 2021 year on behalf of the Harvard University, Boston University, Northwestern University, and University of New Mexico Global Health Fellows Consortium. Their research award is sponsored by the Fogarty International Center, National Institutes of Health. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, her research work in South Africa was postponed to 2021 to 2022. So she's available. Dr. Eugene will be tuning in from South Africa for this session. After the lecture, Dr. Eugene will be responding to your questions. You are encouraged to submit questions via the chat box for our speaker to answer during the Q&A. And now I will turn it over to our presentation.
Hello. Hello there. Thank you so much for that introduction. Again, as was mentioned, my name is Dr. Dominique Eugene. Today we'll be talking about how to have an open dialogue about race, bias, and discrimination when considering the ACEs. The ACEs Aware mission serves as a reminder to the participants to change and save lives by helping providers understand the importance of screening for adverse childhood experiences and training providers to respond with trauma-informed care to mitigate the health impact of toxic stress. Our objectives for today will be to identify, discuss, create, describe. We will identify two factors that contribute to current racial, ethnic, and economic disparities faced by BIPOC child health. We will discuss ways to reflect on our own identities and connect with others to build mutual support on the impact of your identities on social justice. We'll create a personal plan of action to address racial and social injustice in infant mental health daily practice and organizational structures. We will also describe how social determinants of health, including racism, discrimination, may be risk factors for toxic stress, and how you can incorporate culturally sensitive approaches in ACEs screening and responses. The term adverse childhood experiences come from the landmark 1998 study conducted among more than 17,000 adult patients by the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention in Kaiser Permanente. The term ACEs specifically refers to the 10 categories of adversities in three domains experienced by age 18 that were evaluated in the study. That includes abuse, physical, emotional, or sexual, neglect, physical or emotional, or household challenges, which is basically growing up in household with parental incarceration, mental illness, substance dependence, absence due to separation or divorce, or intimate partner violence. Other factors such as racial discrimination, separation from a parent or a caregiver, or other reasons like deportation, migration, or even medical trauma may also be risk factors for toxic stress. We will go into more detail about how different environmental factors and contexts play a role in how we respond to and treat adverse childhood experiences. ACEs are risk factors for toxic stress, and other adversities can also be risk factors for toxic stress. Other factors that reduce the likelihood of developing a toxic stress response include freedom from discrimination, supportive friend networks, safe neighborhoods, and community resources like access to high-quality healthcare, nutrition, and childcare. The biological stress response has been categorized as falling into three types: positive, tolerable, and toxic. Do note not all stress is bad. Some is even necessary and essential part of growing up and development. When it comes to positive stress response, it can help mobilize energy and increase focus to better perform tasks at hand, such as upcoming tests, big games, and even presentations. The positive stress response is categorized by brief elevations in stress hormones, heart rate, and blood pressure in response to routine stressor. Tolerable stress response activates the body's alert systems to a greater degree as a result of more severe, long-lasting difficulties, such as the loss of a loved one, natural disaster, or frightening injury. If activation is time-limited and buffered by relationships with adults who help the child adapt, the brain and other organs recover from what might otherwise be damaging effects. Toxic stress response includes the prolonged activations of the stress response system that can disrupt the development of the brain architecture and other organ systems and increase the risk for stress-related disease and cognitive impairment. Well into the adult years, for children, the result is disruption of the development of the brain architecture and other organ systems and an increase in lifelong risk for physical and mental health disorders. The following two graphics describe different ways in which environment and context play a role in our health and experiences of trauma. Understanding how these systems operate and overlap helps us as providers understand how to approach screening and treatment of ACEs with our patients, families, and communities as a whole. There's a level of mistrust that occurs in the communities. There's levels of personal vulnerabilities. The individual's current life circumstances, their personal history, coping style, and personality characteristics all affect how they are impacted by the work. In addition, working in a challenging profession, most helping professionals have other life stresses to deal with. Many are in the sandwich generation, meaning that they take care of both younger children and aging parents. Helpers are not immune to pain in their own lives. And in fact, some studies show that they are more vulnerable to life challenges, such as divorce and difficulties, such as addictions, than other people who are in stressful working environments. Work-related traumatic grief and loss. Traumatic events in the workplace, such as loss of a colleague through retirement or other career challenges, loss of a beloved leader, school closure, funding issues, death of a child, death of a colleague, any critical incident, all create some level of grief and loss in the workplace environment. When we're talking about direct exposure refers to traumatic events that happens directly in the individual in question. In the context of helping professionals, there are two kinds of direct exposures, also called primary trauma. History of childhood abuse, high ACEs score, having escaped a war-torn country, a traumatic loss in their personal life, surviving a motorcycle accident or a vehicle accident. All this research has shown that over 60% of helping professionals have a trauma history of their own, which may be why they choose the field that they work in. That in itself is not a problem. The challenge arises when helpers go into the field without having done their own trauma work and are not aware of the ways in which their trauma history negatively impacts the work that they do. It can also make us more vulnerable to developing vicarious trauma when dealing with all these victims and pain and suffering that they hear on a daily basis. Primary trauma is caused by work-related exposures. This type of primary trauma exposure occurs in the line of duty, such as working as a firefighter, a search and rescuer operator, being a first responder to an accident or crime scene, being in a lockdown or negotiating a hostage takedown, working in a war-torn country, any unsafe conditions. What makes it a primary is that it is happening to you. During this traumatic situation, you are potentially in harm's way and you are overwhelmed by the horror and terror of the situation. Indirect trauma, also known as secondary or vicarious trauma, is caused by indirect exposure to trauma. You're not in actual danger. You're not even at the scene of the site. But the results of shooting rampage or accident has an impact on you. These stories are described to you verbally, in writing, through audio or video recording. Because of that exposure, it could also occur during counseling services, when you're sitting with a client, when you're reading their files, when you're getting a debriefing of events that have occurred, or even watching traumatic news footage. Many first responders, such as firefighters and paramedics, are at risk of developing primary trauma, in addition to the secondary trauma they're exposed to in the line of duty. When we think of empathic strain or compassion fatigue refers to the profound emotional and physical exhaustion that helping professionals and caregivers can develop over the course of their career as helpers. It is a gradual erosion of all things that keep us connected to others in a caregiver role. Our empathy, our hope, and of course our compassion, not only for others but also for ourselves. When we are suffering from compassion fatigue, we start seeing changes in our personal and professional lives. We can become dispirited, increasingly bitter. We may contribute to a toxic work environment. We are more prone to work errors. We may violate confidentiality and we lose respect at the stance of the people that we're working with are supposed to be protecting. We become short-tempered. We are loved ones with the people that we are working with overall. And over time, it erodes and takes its toll on us. Systems failures. Grappling with roadblocks in the systems we work with. Feeling angry or frustrated, a lack of resources, disagreeing about someone's eligibility for services. There are many examples of failure. One result of facing these numerous challenges is moral distress. Moral distress occurs when we are told to do things that we fundamentally disagree with or morally opposed to. when our values conflict with what is required by law or other rules of regulations. Working conditions are profoundly affected by our workplace relationships, sense of trust, quality of communication, perceptions of fairness, workload, who we directly report to, overall workplace climate, rewards, recognitions, and other factors. So in discussing increased risks and multiple exposures, there's also the social cultural context. The social cultural context of community, state, or country that we live in can profoundly impact our daily levels of stress. Being a member of a minority group and having to navigate discrimination or safety concerns on our way to and from work, and even in the workplace. The current political climate, media, exposure to cyberbullying, etc., all creates this toxic environment that we reside in and increase risk factors. The eco-biodevelopmental model of human health and disease displays the ways in which ecology, biology, and development overlap. Ecology becomes biology, and together they drive development across the lifespan. Of note, it is the phenomenon of epigenetics that plays a role in the presence of adverse experiences and transmission of toxic stress through the altering of gene expression. Predisposing vulnerabilities and early life adversities like racism, discrimination, and additional social detriments of health that are considered environmental factors that can lead to the activation of the toxic stress response. As clinicians, it is our role to learn how to recognize these neuroendocrine and metabolic symptoms as well as additional implications that impact physical, mental, and emotional when screening for ACEs. As we've mentioned before, it is important to recognize that the 10 ACEs identified in the landmark study are not the only risk factors for toxic stress and subsequent health disparities. Other factors such as racial discrimination related to race, living in poverty, separation from a parent or a caregiver, either for other reasons like deportation or migration, exposure to climate disasters, or even medical trauma may also impact risk factors of toxic stress. When we're taking into consideration economic and education, there's a level of racial and ethnic disparities that exist. 51% of babies born in the U.S. in 2018 are children of color. 1 in 5 of the children born today begins their life already living in poverty, and nearly half live in households earning less than twice the federal poverty level. 37% black children are 0 to 2, and 26% of Latinx children ages 0 to 2 live in poverty, compared to only 12% of white children. Increased economic insecurity due to child care, low wages, unequal housing, access to quality education, all plays its toll on stress. Distressed neighborhoods with underrepresented environments, low economic status, low physical access to services, social and educational pitfalls. These are all places where families are under the greatest stress, and ACEs in the home are more likely to occur. Additionally, these places tend to be where there are more environmental hazards that in turn have negative impact on physical health and increased risk for toxic stress. Here are a few examples of some of the healthcare-related disparities that I will go into further. There's levels of maternal and infant health mortality rates that are low. There's the impact of COVID-19 on infection and mortality rates. Access to equitability services for people with developmental disabilities all hinders and creates a toxic environment. One example is the maternal and infant mortality disparities here in the U.S. The association of worse maternal health outcomes in Black and Native American women than in other demographic groups is thought to be due in part to pregnancy, stress, trauma, discrimination, and other challenging effects. In 2018, infant mortality rates by race and ethnicity were as follows: non-Hispanic Black, 10.8%, Native Hawaiian or other Pacific Islander, 9.4%, American Indian Alaska Native, 8.2%, Hispanic, 4.9%, non-Hispanic White, 4.6%, and Asian, 3.6%. Non-white children are a higher rate of death. Again, this all contribute to toxic stress environments and increased numbers of ACEs scores. COVID-19 hospitalization and mortality disparities were at the forefront during this pandemic. Race and ethnicity are risk markers for other underlying conditions that affect health, including socioeconomic status, access to healthcare, and exposure to the virus related to occupation, such as being frontline, essential, or critical infrastructure workers. Black Americans have a higher risk of morbidity and mortality from COVID-19 due to greater rates of pre-existing chronic conditions that promote more serious infection, such as heart disease, high blood pressure, chronic lung disease, diabetes, or kidney disease. Decreased access to health care and an increased cumulative adversity over the lifetime, leading to increased biological weathering or accelerating aging, which are known to risk factors to greater complications of COVID-19. When we think of mental health and we think of health as a whole, COVID-19 has taken its toll on a lot of the BIPOC communities, the Black, Indigenous, people of color communities. Review of data on disparities confronting inequities of California's funding services for children with developmental disabilities proved to show a sobering impact just as well. An analysis of point of service data in 2018 through 2019 shows that each Hispanic child received 69% of the funding that each white child received on average. Disparities between the two groups grew by 60% in 4 years. And that's just regional center services for kiddos. The people that we're working with, the families that we're dealing with. The disparities in service authorization between white and Hispanic children decreased in only 3 regional centers and grew in the other 18 regional centers when comparing from 2018-19 data from 2015-16. Each Asian child received 84% of the funding that each white child received on average. Disparity between these two groups grew by 68% just in the past year. Each Spanish-speaking child received 82% of funding that each English-speaking child received on average. Disparity between these two groups grew by 46% in four years. So, we've talked a lot about ACEs. We've gone through a lot of background and history, how ACEs came to be, what we needed to do, how we needed to do the things that we do. We're all now ACEs informed. Now what do we do with this information? We know that the disparities exist. How to proceed with the services that we need to do to be better doctors, to be better providers. When we think of levels of advocacy, what is our role in the way that we provide services to our communities that we work with? What are the racial injustices that these people are still dealing with? What are the habits and hurtful microaggressions that includes diagnosing? And how are we as individuals of privilege confront and disrupt with using a sense of accomplishment? We've heard a lot about allyship and working with communities and standing with the communities and all lives matters, Black lives matters, Spanish lives matters, children lives matters. The difference between being an ally and an accomplice is that, as an ally, it's about the individual with privileged identities using their privilege to disrupt oppression while working alongside people who are part of marginalized groups toward realizing equity and social justice. Whereas being an accomplice, the actions of the accomplice as directly challenging institutionalized racism, colonization, and white supremacy by blocking or impeding racist people, policies, and structures. Being an accomplice means standing side by side and speaking against the injustice that occur. It is attending workshops focused on several key racial injustice habits and hurtful microaggressions generated through white privilege. It is dismantling the meaningless mantras that people believe would bring out a sufficient social justice disruption. The need to actively help marginalized and oppressed peoples accomplish the work of obtaining equity and bringing about diversity and inclusion by taking an active part, not just talking about it, but doing it. As we begin this conversation, it's trying to find ways to better serve our communities, to address our own biases, to understand where we stand in the spectrum of either colorism or stigma or misunderstanding. It is having that difficult conversation. It is speaking about race. It is speaking about color and how that plays its impact. And it speaks from the place of being a privileged individual as well. There's a lot of stigma that goes into the work that we do, either as doctors, mental health workers, or helping profession as a whole. How do we go about countering stigma? How do we develop our practice in a way that promotes care and family engagement? How do we increase involvement in campaigns for health literacy and cultural competence? What are we doing to advocate for policy changes that promote healthcare effectiveness, not just government agendas? What is needed to conduct more research that examines connection between stigma and help-seeking behaviors? Advocating for your patients, promoting culturally competent environment, fostering a trauma-informed environment and care, and actively working in a counter stigmas that may exist of seeking mental health care or health care in general, may exist because of demographic or cultural historical context of seeking acceptance and understanding, can help to improve overall care for patient on a holistic, whole person level. Each of these points are things that we are, as providers, should bear in mind as we work to be more than just ACEs aware or informed. But also, we need to work to create plans with our patients and families for better care and health. The more providers who are trauma-informed and aware of the role in culture, race, socioeconomic status, and other despairing impacts on the society, helps to better us in being able to change the systemic levels of oppression and stress. Policy change is essential to overcome structural stigma that undermines government agendas meant to promote mental health care. Pre-COVID, many mental health clinics were dealing with a lot of adversities to start with. After COVID and during COVID, what do we need to do for mental health to be able, and not just mental health, but medical health, the system, to work collaboratively to work with families, to help families adjust through some of the trying times that they're dealing with? How do we address people being afraid in coming into communities, coming into your hospitals, coming into the clinics for services? There's a lot more work to be done in the services that we conduct. How do we move forward in helping the communities as well as being mindful of where we sit as far as privilege goes, of understanding how our own biases and our levels of distress impact the client's ability to access services or the desire to access services. How do we, as professionals, provide the level of psychoeducation and collateral sessions with families to support persons with necessary services? How do we undermine or deal with some of the patients that come through that have ongoing chronic mental health, chronic health issues, but that might have an underlying impact based on environmental stressors, environmental conditions? How do we assist in helping clients feel better in coming into our system and in our healthcare services? And as individuals, what is our accountability? What do we need to do? It's not just the clients that need to do work, but how do we change the system that we've been thriving in for the most part? How do we move forward with educating providers regarding potential barriers of varying populations? How do we teach ourselves as providers to seek information from patients about concerns or trust issues that they might have that may be impacting them even coming into services? What do we need to do to train and hire clinicians, doctors, healthcare workers, and being able to understand the limitations of language, of issues with cultural disparities? And how do we help the community overall to access organizations that might be limiting in the services or funding sources that they need? How can we integrate primary care and mental health care to community partnerships and community outreach? What is missing from the services that we contribute to people? Increasing research participation, we say that that's a crucial part in terms of being able to help the community and moving forward with changing the system or shaking the system up. In order to increase minority research participation among specific populations, there has to be acknowledgement that historical context of mistrust. There's been studies that's been conducted in the past that people don't feel like we are in their best interest when they come into our closed environments, our closed doors. What do we need to do to provide a venue where causes of mistrust can be discussed openly? Again, as I said earlier, how do we openly discuss microaggression, appropriation, colonial aspects of how we've come to learn the things that we do in the treatment that we provide? How do we facilitate opportunities to learn and ask questions about research process and having the clients feel safe, having the patients feel safe to say, hey, yes, I trust you, so therefore I will come to you and be part of whatever research you're interested in me being? How do we address the fears? Because the fears are still relevant. We're still struggling with a lot of people that don't know where to go, are afraid of being deported, are afraid of speaking their mind, are afraid of the bigger system. How do we explicitly address concerns about unintended consequences based on the services that we say we want to provide? So here we are. Cultural sensitivity. What does that mean to you? What does that mean to me? It's one of those topics that never go away, and I'm sure last year people struggled with what that really means and health disparities and everything else that's going on. When we're talking about cultural sensitivity, it doesn't mean that you're less cultural. It just means that people that are coming to us or that are coming to our clinics, your clinics for services, they're coming from a different lens. Observe our own and patients' reactions to racial oppression. Not to minimize their concerns. Recognize the influence of Black, Indigenous people of color, the cultural issues that they've been facing. and how that plays in its impact on their services that they come to you for. Recognize the influence of majority culture on patients. A lot of clients that I've worked with, they'll nod yes to every doctor. You have a doctor in front of your name, they'll just say yes to everything. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they agree with the services that you want them to pursue. Understanding our own patients' personal experiences. I know a lot of times as medical doctors, as people in the healing field, time is limited. But sometimes we need to slow down, take a minute, and to really assess what is going on with this patient, with this client, with this family. These are a few recommendations for providers and the healthcare teams to bear in mind for themselves and their patients when screening for ACEs to promote a culturally informed and trauma-informed system. Current research states that culturally specific models of treatment must aim to provide and incorporate greater benefits for patients who are accustomed to being marginalized, who are accustomed to being treated as insignificant, who are accustomed to feeling depersonalized. In counseling BIPOC populations, a lot of researchers say that promoting insight regarding the most effective ways of empathizing and treating this population in a clinical setting is imperative. Some patients may have preferences for the clinician's ethnicity, which is related to their current stage of racial identity. Most important clinician's characteristic is often culturally sensitive. It's not necessarily being the same color, but being able to really understand and taking that cultural humility stance. Clinicians that incorporate these aspects into clinical treatment may help patients to determine treatment expectations, discuss support systems and coping strategies, and help determine the impact of external factors. Who are their support system? Who are the person that they go to for services? Who do they talk to? Is it their churchman? Is it their curandero? Is it their, who in their community are they going to other than you? In general, culturally sensitive clinicians assist patients in defining treatment goals, not just throwing diagnoses at them and not explaining to them. It's determining the effect of other factors on future goals and developing healthy racial socialization. Where do we go from here? And how do we be more culturally competent, culturally relevant? Last year, I attended a training where the facilitator expressed the concept of being called cultural humility instead of cultural competence. That in itself left a lasting impression on me. Whereas cultural competency is the idea of being filled up with getting to a certain point of knowledge, cultural humility encourages to remain curious about the different cultures and opens the possibilities of learning more. We don't know everything, regardless of our degrees or regardless of our status in society. We have to approach people that we work with, people that we serve, people that we treat with respect and humility. And of course, in the past few years, there's been a lot of issues with, you know, immigration, people coming into the country seeking for safety. The United States continues to be the hub of safety for many people. Immigrant families, immigrant children, immigrants as a whole, seeking safe haven in the United States. Whether they're arriving unaccompanied or in family units, they all face complicated evaluations and legal process from the point of arrival through the permanent resettlement in communities. The conditions in which children are detained and the support services that are available to them are a great of concern to pediatricians and other advocates for children. In accordance with internationally accepted rights of the child, immigrant and refugee children should be treated with dignity and respect, should not be exposed to conditions that may harm or traumatize them. Yet here we are. We have children who are still remaining in cages, new children who are trying to make their way through and living in conditions that feel like it's cages. Through the K principles of trauma-informed care, providers can be more prepared to screen their patients for adverse childhood experiences in a manner that promotes safety, dignity, and respect. The healthcare setting also provides an opportunity to help patients and families develop skills and capacities necessary to increase positive buffering experiences to prevent ACEs and toxic stress. How do we do all that? How do we go about advocating for family reunification? What do we need to do to provide a sense of safety? How do we assure medical care is provided with the limited fundings that every community has, every doctor has? How do we effectively assess for mental illness? Yet, we need to find ways to advocate for qualified staff that are capable to work with children, to work with families, to work with the underserved populations. Detention of children for immigration purposes is known to be practiced in over 100 countries worldwide, despite significant body of research demonstrating the extensive harm of such policies. This review explores contextualizing the key potential impacts of family separation and detention of children for immigration purposes, including damaged attachment, damaged relationships, traumatization, toxic stress, and wider detrimental impacts on immigration in immigrant communities. As such, it is critical for any host nation, host country, to do what needs to be done to promote policies that protect children from further harm, promote resilience, and enable recovery. The ACEs studies impact everybody in every aspect of their lives, some more detrimental than others. We will continue having high ACEs scores for a number of people until we address the underlying impact or the causes of these events. So what do you do? That's a very good question. Where do you stand in the spectrum? What is your personal action plan? What are the things that you can do to effectively work with the communities that you work with? It took the ACEs studies to show that there was something drastically wrong with a lot of the people that we work with and the people that we serve. It took the ACEs studies to show that there is more that goes on to the mechanism of change and safety and well-being. So how do you use your voice and influence to address the issues of social injustice or social justice? How do we address the racial inequities that consist? Most of all, how do we have an honest conversation that there is disparities? These are the things to consider. These are the things to work with. These are the things that we need to keep in mind as we're going through our day-to-day aspects. How do we have that honest conversation of something is not right? What do we need to do better? What's your responsibility as healthcare providers? Is it just another ACEs checkoff screening box that we need to conduct? Or do we do something different and more significant? So as we consider all this, I leave you with, what is your personal action plan? What will you do differently? How can you make a difference? How do you make a difference one step at a time? What actions can you take to challenge yourself, the organizations that you work with, to further address this crisis? How do we feel safe in our own skin to even have that kind of conversation? Or do we continuously scurry away from it because it's not happening or turn the blind eye? We are in the healing profession because we want to heal and at the same time to be healed. What do we need to do to make that happen? And as I wrap this up, I thank you so much and I leave you with these quotes. Not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced. What are we facing and what do we need to deal with? And these are generational aspects of life. These are events that take place repeatedly. Events that take place throughout the decades that repeat itself. It is not enough to be compassionate. You need to act. And how do we act and move forward together? Thank you.
Thank you to Dr. Eugene for that really informative presentation. We are about to start the Q&A session. I know that I've been getting some information that Dr. Eugene is on the line, but she's in South Africa and she may be having some difficulties with her internet connection. So I'm just gonna pause for a moment and see if Dr. Eugene is able to hear us and if she's able to join us.
Hello, everybody. Yes, I'm here as the sun is starting to rise.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for joining us from across the world. This is really exciting. We appreciate it. So we are going to start the Q&A portion of our presentation. So if anybody has any questions for Dr. Eugene, please put them in the chat box. You're also welcome to use the raise your hand function, which is if you go under the menu bar on the bottom under reactions, you can raise your hand. Of course, you can unmute and ask your question. So here's your opportunity. If you had any burning questions throughout the presentation. Keep an eye on the chat along with my colleagues to make sure I don't miss anything. Well, I did have one that kind of came up earlier and I thought about too is the concept of cultural humility is really interesting. I've heard bits and pieces of it myself and we're wondering if you can expand on that concept a little bit and how do you see that becoming a bigger part of ACES Aware, the ACES Aware initiative and program? Uh-oh, Dr. Eugene, I don't know if we can hear you.
Oh, could you hear me now? Could you hear me now?
Yes, now we can hear you.
When we think about cultural humility, I'm talking about a perspective of not being the one that's in the authoritative stance, not being the one that is perceived as knowing it all, understanding that we do have our limitations as professionals. There are things that we really don't know about many cultures, and being able to address it from a stance of like, sharing with the clients, sharing with the patients, sharing with the people that you really don't know a lot about their community, that you might not know a lot about their community, you might not know a lot about the prospects, the ethnicities, the events that has brought them to you at the time that they're coming in for services. It's working collaboratively with them to help them be a teacher to you as much as you are to them, and working with them collaboratively so that they're really in a place that they feel safe, supported, and heard, not from a place of top down and demeaning to them.
Lori, do you have a question?
Well, I think that was just really not fair.
Please tell me more.
Because that voice was the safe, supportive place to go to and listen to. And I won't be sleeping tonight. So I just want to tell you that thank you so much. Thank you.
I agree. I'm like, your voice is very warm and it's perfect for this topic.
Oh yeah. And it was so easy to fall into, let me listen to this even more and deeper. And then it was like, so yes.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
I see that there's a question that's come into the chat. And the question is, do you see the sandwich generation having an increased difficulty in accepting and embracing the models of change that create a more healthy, balanced, and resilient lifestyle?
Absolutely. And when we're talking about the sandwich community, the sandwich generation, we're referring to those who are taking care of their own parents and taking care of their children, being stuck between two worlds and not knowing how to move forward, having added responsibility of taking care of various generations. And when we think of multi-generations that live together, there's a plethora of difficulties and sense of obligation, sense of needing to do for the family and be there for the family at all costs. Unfortunately, all costs is all that. It is at all costs. Your health becomes compromised. Your health deteriorates. It makes you more susceptible to diseases and viruses. But it's also one of those situations of feeling so indebted and so committed to family structure that you're not thinking of what you need to do. As you know, people hear it all the time, that need to put your own mask on first. These days, we all have to wear our masks. But you know, on when you're thinking about the airplanes, when we're able to safely go on airplanes, having to put the oxygen mask on first becomes a foreign concept for so many people, because the added pressure to really do whatever it takes to really help the family structure puts you at risk in so many ways.
And I think we see a reminder too that if you do have a question, again, feel free to put it in the chat box, or you're welcome to just unmute yourself or raise your hand if you have a question. And I think going picking back kind of on what I asked earlier about ACES Aware, you know, this initiative has been running for a little while now. How do you see, again, some of these concepts being built into the initiative a little bit more? Or because I know it was a starting point, right, to start with the initial screening. Let's just do the screening. But how do we start to build in, you know, cultural humility and other these other concepts that you're talking about as we move forward?
Well, it's not enough just to check off the box, as I said in the presentation. We have to act upon it. We have to move forward with it. We're under siege in terms of what we need to do to really show, you know, put our money where our mouth is, to really be able to move forward and do something about it, not just say it like, okay, and then you forget it about it until the client, the patient comes the next time around. We have to do it on a constant basis, on a regular basis. We have to live by example, not just saying, hey, we did our due diligence, we crossed it off, we met the checkbox requirements. But then what? How does that play itself out in your own household? How does that play itself out when you're outside, when you're going for a jog, when you're at the supermarket? How does that play itself out when we're just dealing with humanity on a day-to-day basis? What can we really do to incorporate? What can we really do to incorporate the things that we are trying to get other people to do? How do we do that forcefully and earnestly? We say a lot of things, and as healers, we tend to be the biggest hypocrite when it comes to following what we tell other people to do. You know, it's the same thing like you do as I say and not as I do. Well, we have to change that around. We have to really do a lot more of self-reflection, of self-acknowledgement, of understanding where and how we've come to learn the things that we've come, and the social concepts that have come with that, and the colonization that comes with that as well. What do we need to do to really shake up the system and consistently, not just because it's the topic of the day?
I like that, shake up the system, because I agree with you. You know, I've been in different places where it does feel a little bit more like a check the box exercise. And so I think, what can we do to mix things up and really shake it up? Great. I think we might have time for one more question. If anybody has something that they'd like to ask, I know you have a couple of ways of doing it. So please feel free while we have Dr. Eugene.
And as we're waiting for people to ask that final question, I do want to add, there's always an opportunity to reset. We are not always going to get it right. We will blunder, we will make errors. We need to find ways to be able to repair that fracture, not just from a medical standpoint, but from a humanistic standpoint. How do we reset? It's basically when you see the client again, the patient again, the person again, you share with them that you acknowledge that you realize something might not have set well last time when you met with them, and you wanted to have an opportunity to address that, time permitting. And even if time does not permit, but just providing them the atmosphere and the safety to feel that you acknowledge that something went wrong and you would like to make things better.
I actually really like that a lot, because I think you said too, as professionals, we kind of want to show that we know everything, or at least have the appearance of, and we don't. We can't possibly, right? So I think I like that a lot. I think we have one final question that did come in through the chat, and it is, can you give a few examples of how we can carefully address or make recommendations towards resilient self-care practices and seek to empower and advocate self-worth with mindful acceptance?
That's a mouthful. Learn to tune out, learn to turn off the television, learn to stop listening to the news, learn to realize that life in itself can be anxiety provoking. So we have to be fully aware of how it impacts us, how it impacts our bodies. I mean, for physicians and psychologists and the healing profession, we suck at that. We can tell people what they need to do, the vitamins that they need to take, the sunshine that they need to help them go forth with their lives, but we don't do that ourselves. We pack our schedules back to back. We're not taking time out just to sit still, just to hear the birds singing, or just to see the change in weather or the change of temperature or anything. We really need to be just what it says, to be mindful, to be aware. You know, I always joke about this song, and I always think of it in terms of like, look up, look down, look around. See the beauty that's around us in the midst of the chaos. Be mindful, be aware, be alert. Sit still. For that matter, listen to your heartbeat. How amazing that we still have a heartbeat despite all the craziness we put ourselves through.
I think those are beautiful words to end on. So thank you for that. I appreciate everybody's attention and your thoughtful questions. So hopefully we've got a better sense of social determinants like race, culture, environment, how we should consider those when we're providing holistic care, particularly in the context of ACEs, which is what we're discussing tonight. Thank you, Dr. Eugene, for tuning in with us. We know it's really super, super early where you are. So we hope you have a wonderful day and that you get a chance to listen to the birds and feel the sunshine and all of that as we start to go to bed tonight.
Sunrising at this point, but we'll do without.
Okay. Whatever comes your way. We are going to have a few more important reminders from the Landon Pediatric Foundation ACEs grant coordinators, and then I think then we'll sign off for the evening. So thank you, everybody.
Thank you again for watching this lecture. Remember to complete the registration and evaluation. We will contact you soon if you are one of our raffle winners, so stay tuned.
Make sure to follow us on all our social media accounts and subscribe on our webpage for more information of our 12 lecture series, ACEs Aware Ventura County, and all things ACEs Aware.
Thank you for joining us on our mission to bring better help,
better health,
and better hope to Ventura County and beyond.
Bye. See you at our next session.
And with that, we will close out this session. Again, thank you to Dr. Eugene for getting up so early to come on and answer those questions and present to us tonight. And I hope you all have a good rest of your evening, and Dr. Eugene, a good start to your day. Again, these are a few reminders. The evaluation is linked here, as well as our contact information. And at the end of this session, I will be randomizing our session drawing winner, and that will be included in our follow-up email. So look out for an email from me later on. Thank you.